Hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. I'm Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, or SAFE, and I have my wonderful co-hosts here today.
Greg Rodriguez with Stantec.
And Pete Gould with Shared Mobility Strategies.
And we're thrilled for this episode today because we have Ryan Poppel, the CEO of Proterra, on the podcast. Ryan, welcome to the podcast. And I guess just to start us off, so Proterra produces electric buses and has been getting a lot of attention in this space. And electric buses are really moving sort of into sort of the forefront of the transportation discussion. But first, I'd like to hear about how you got involved in the industry, because you have sort of an interesting story and what led you here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me this morning. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and the listeners. My journey to electric vehicles started in 2006. I had finished up business school and was very much interested in working on something related to energy security and the future of energy. And quite a bit of that was driven by spending 4 years on active duty in the U.S. Army, some of that time in the Middle East, and just coming away from that experience thinking that what we're currently doing is not strategically sustainable, and having a sense of how vulnerable the current supply chain is, and how much we take for granted the fact that the world effectively needs about 100 million barrels of a specific commodity every day, or things start stopping. So I was very much interested in the alternative energy space, but with a focus on transportation and what I would call the oil problem. And in 2006, there were a lot of different approaches. I remember attending a seminar at Berkeley, mm-hmm. and there were three different paths: biofuels, hydrogen, and EV. And I think at that time, EV probably had the least mind share in terms of viability. I would rank it probably as biofuels, hydrogen, and then battery, because batteries were heavy and expensive. So I started on biofuels, but then got an offer from Tesla when they had about 200 employees in 2007. And was really fascinated by what Tesla was doing to drive up the performance and drive down the cost of EV tech. And having spent a little bit of time in the biofuel industry, I also was fascinated about the fact that there already was an existing industry and infrastructure that delivered electricity and could facilitate the transition to electric vehicles. One of the problems everyone ran into in biofuels is that there really isn't biofuel distribution infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And if you want to distribute biofuels, you're going to have to work with the same people who currently maintain an oil monopoly. Mm-hmm. So you might get a few percent of biofuels, but you're never going to get their active strategic help right. in causing their core business to go away.
You have the incumbents fighting against any sort of change, of course.
Yeah, in some ways, they literally have their hand on the throttle because mm-hmm. they own the liquid distribution infrastructure. What I think is so fascinating about electric is for the first time you can change that, and you also have a big enough industry, the electricity industry, to somewhat counterbalance the influence of the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I guess the beautiful thing is that with EVs, the infrastructure is already there. It's domestically produced. You have all of these different sources, and so it makes a lot of sense. But so you were at Tesla, and then you chose to leave in order to pursue electric buses. Why buses? Why not boats? Why not planes? Why not
scooters.
Helicopters, yeah. Well, I mean, I very much believe in the strategy of electrify everything, but we also need to deploy resources in, I would say, economic priority, in that as you look at the development of electric vehicle technology and the price of electric vehicle technology, the first place you should start is in the markets where you right now have a viable business case and a viable operating model. And what I learned about the transit industry is that the characteristics of how transit bus operates, that fits really well with EV technology and EV charging today. Mm-hmm. And if you're introducing a new technology to market, you want to go against the least efficient application of the legacy technology. So if you have new LED technology, you probably want to go to market against inefficient incandescent light bulbs that are being run all the time. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's buses within the transportation world. They're lucky to get 4 miles per gallon on diesel. They're running almost all the time in big cities. So you're looking at 40,000 miles a year. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that pencils out to being 10,000 gallons of diesel per year.
And per bus?
per bus. That's right. So every mile that a diesel bus goes down the road, it burns a quarter gallon of diesel and emits it as air pollution. So it is a hyper user of fuel. It's also, though, these vehicles are depot-based, and they're operated by skilled teams that are trained to own and operate the vehicle fleet. And that's important because you're going to need people who form the base of support for this new technology. Mm-hmm. So we liked a lot of aspects of the transit market. And we also have seen, as time has gone by, international validation of that strategy. It's hard to find a modern global city mm-hmm. that isn't planning for the electrification of their city bus fleet.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we're talking about a couple of things that are very timely. One, I thought was interesting you talking about the conference you went to in Berkeley and the different technologies, and obviously we just had the Nobel Prize winners related to the lithium battery. How much do you think technology has played a role or a huge invention like, you know, understanding lithium batteries and its storage capacity has played in kind of this new momentum around electrification?
I think it's almost 100% responsible for the acceleration of electrification. And I think about the cost of a battery pack in 2007 for a vehicle like the Tesla Roadster. Or I think about the cost of a battery pack, the weight of a battery pack for some of Proterra's first electric buses, and the lack of range that they had in that era. And the biggest story as to why the world is changing and why electricity is starting to eat into the market share of everything is the batteries. And, you know, just a really simple example of that is think about the power tool market. Mm-hmm. 10, 15 years ago, if you were a serious contractor, you were going to run on plug-in tools or air compressor power tools. Mm-hmm. As lithium-ion batteries started to penetrate the power tool sector, now you go down the aisle at Lowe's, and every single tool is available as a high-power, high-energy, rechargeable lithium-ion powered tool.
Up to like a leaf blower, which you would think was always going to...
Which, thank goodness. I mean, I'm not going to go on my rant about gas-powered leaf blowers, but I am looking forward to no longer hearing that sound.
You know, when we were thinking about which vehicles were louder, we had a really tough debate. Do we start with the city bus market or the leaf blower market? But the leaf blower market came close.
You didn't strike me as an anti leaf blower.
Yeah, no, Saturday morning you're not happy with the leaf blower.
Yeah. Yeah. How long have we known you?
Anyways.
Yeah, so battery, you know, and the battery progression has been remarkable. And there's I'd say conventional wisdom that suggests that batteries aren't improving or they're not improving very fast. Those articles are written by people who are not battery experts and not in the industry. Like, mm-hmm. if you're actually in the business of procuring lithium-ion batteries, testing them, introducing new versions of the technology, you have experienced, or I have experienced, a 12-year relentless march on cost, quality, improvement in cycles. And that's why we're reaching a tipping point in many of these markets. Batteries are not $1,000 a kilowatt hour. They've dropped 80%. So that's what has unlocked this.
Mm-hmm. What drove that?
Part of it is learning curve. Just the more batteries that the industry has built around the lithium ion format, the more experience they've gained, and the more they've learned to optimize them. There's also the experience curve that for every doubling of capacity globally, you just get economies of scale. You get bigger factories. I've visited factories where cells are produced at 300 parts per minute. So when you are reaching that level of industrial scale, now you're getting very, very efficient amortization of factory cost. And then on the technology side, there hasn't been a fundamental breakthrough of lithium to a post-lithium battery in a commercial sense. But there have been all sorts of different pedigrees of lithium-ion batteries. So, you know, in 2007, we were working with lithium cobalt oxide batteries, and they had about 700 deep discharge cycles. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty difficult to manage.
Can you explain what a deep discharge cycle is?
Sure. It'd be if you charge the battery all the way up and let it discharge all the way down. So that would suggest that if someone used that battery fully every day, you know, the product would last 2 years.
Yeah.
Now we're in a world where batteries have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 cycles. They're much more energy dense. And they can fast charge much more easily than previous batteries. So it isn't just a cost story, it's an innovation story. And it's multi-billion dollar industry. It's as big of a prize in the 21st century as oil was in the 20th. So there's billions of dollars of R&D going into it.
And maybe as we do batteries 101, I think this is really interesting. You know, one of the things you talked about is the ability for electrification or electric buses to produce, you know, cleaner buses. And then, you know, obviously leaf blowers, like, again, going back to that horrible amount of emissions coming out of those, which is my other problem in addition to the sounds. But one of the things that comes up when you're talking about batteries is how are we going to dispose of them or be able to recycle them? There's a great article in the New York Times or the Post, I forget which one, just a perspective about earbuds, and they're only expected to last 18 months, and they're not really reusable after that. So where do you see that discussion going, especially as cities are starting to think about what are the potential environmental impacts of batteries?
Well, recognizing that we needed to build battery systems that were infrastructure grade and long life, we thought about reusability and recyclability for our battery packs from the beginning. And we view it in a first life, second life, third life framework. First life is in a transportation asset, and that's probably going to be from 6 to 12 years. Second life is going to be as a stationary storage application or potentially a low mileage vehicle application. So you don't need that large of a battery if you're only doing 40 miles a day or 20 miles a day. So just like engines are rebuilt and refurbished, the battery industry could do the same. And then third life is recyclability. The way we've designed our systems, depending on commodity prices, we anticipate 70 to 90% recyclability. There are battery technologies out there, though, that have very limited recyclability. And I think as an industry, we need to get to standardization and waste tolerance levels to make sure that we are not creating a electronic waste problem. I do try to encourage people to keep it in perspective, though, because there currently is no way to recycle or capture the air pollution from fossil fuels. Right. And so when we're talking about a 12-year bus, we're looking at four 1,500-pound battery packs and 80% recyclability after 20 years of use in two markets. And you compare that to the amount of air pollution, which is real. We just use the air around us as the dumping ground for it. And, you know, it's on the millions of pounds of air pollution.
And just to clarify, the different levels of potential use of batteries that you're describing, is that how Proterra's approaching the batteries, or are you talking about the industry as a whole?
That's how we're approaching it. I mean, we know these batteries have a lot of life after their transportation mission. And you're taking a battery from a daily use scenario to potentially a backup use scenario. And the value of backup is an insurance policy, but it doesn't necessarily, you're not using cycles every day. So in some ways, a brand new battery system may be a poor fit for just backing up power and being resilient, because it's going to be very expensive and your utilization of it is going to be very low.
Mm-hmm. So turning to sort of the electric bus 101, I think the thing that folks need to understand is that building an electric bus isn't just building a longer, bigger car, right? There are some different engineering aspects that you're trying to solve. So what's inherent in that, as well as, I guess, the infrastructure issues too that you've had to tackle?
So I think one of the things that's very different about the commercial vehicle industry than the light duty industry is how much your payload can vary. And if you design an electric car, the car is going to weigh, let's say a full size sedan weighs 4,000 pounds. You put a 200 pound human in it, and you've barely affected the power level, the suspension of the vehicle, the durability of the vehicle. Trucks and buses, though, when they're empty, they can weigh 10 to 20,000 pounds less than when they're full. So from a durability perspective, suspension, body design, as well as drivetrain power, you have to design towards the peak payload, but you also, you don't want to do that through brute force and therefore have a very inefficient vehicle when it's not at peak payload. Mm-hmm. There's also, we have to design for more miles per day than a car operates. Mm-hmm. Transit buses go on average 130 miles a day, you know, 30, 40,000 miles a year, that's 4 to 5 times more than a car. So when we think about the motors and the batteries, our systems require much longer cycle lives than cars. And, you know, last but not least, we think about things like the urban focus of the application and the ability to carry as many passengers as possible. So it is a very different mission than a light duty vehicle.
Absolutely.
And maybe just a question from the safety perspective. Obviously, you know, hybrid and electric vehicles, people are used to hearing the sound of cars. People are obviously used to hearing the sound of buses. Are you thinking at all about that when you talk about operating in an urban environment? Any sort of sounds or anything that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, absolutely. The good news is that the transit industry in North America has already done a lot of work on accessibility and safety so that transit systems can safely transport every potential passenger, regardless of physical ability level. And that has meant that transit for a long time has thought about how do buses and trains interact with visually impaired, as an example. So even before electric buses arrived on the scene, there were configurations and products, and you can hear them sometimes over the roar of the diesel, that announces things like left turn, right turn, bus approaching, bus departing. So the fortunate thing is we didn't have to reinvent the wheel on that one. And it has been a city by city and county by county decision as to what type of auditory announcement systems they want to use or what type of camera systems they want to use to prevent injuries or accidents. I actually think, in it, you know, as a cyclist, I would prefer to be next to an electric bus if I'm in the bike lane, because when you are next to a diesel bus or a CNG bus, your ability to understand what's going around you in the world is completely cut off.
Yeah.
Because you're caught in just this roaring. So yes, you're aware that there's a bus next to you, but you can't hear what's going on in terms of cross traffic. And you're, you know, inhaling straight fossil fuel emissions at a very high rate. So an electric bus with the proper announcement systems would be much safer in an urban environment. You know, we do not want noisy urban environments. They make things more dangerous, not less.
Yeah, I read this article in The Atlantic recently about how much your blood pressure goes up when there's a factory open nearby and things like that, and the health impacts are massive. So there's definitely a huge benefit there.
One last one, just kind of electric buses and batteries 101. You know, from a transit agency's perspective, if the question is not just what is the life cycle of this of the rolling stock, but what is the life cycle of the battery? You know, when that battery is up, if the is that vehicle done, or is it an easy swap in, swap out?
It depends on how many miles they put on the vehicle per year. Some of our customers lease batteries, some of them buy batteries. It is a relatively straightforward process to swap out batteries. We build. Our batteries are large. They're 110 kilowatt hours each. And our typical vehicle has four of them mounted underneath. So the vehicle goes up on lifts and you can drop the battery packs. We tend to design around either a 6-year or a 12-year battery life. And the 6-year fits well with the maintenance schedule for refurbishing diesel and CNG engines. So there's a misconception, I think, that internal combustion engine vehicles don't have the same sorts of product life challenges that electric vehicles have. And there are many aspects of electric vehicles that will outlast combustion, like your the ability to operate electric motor in terms of total number of miles vastly exceeds an engine. And as we mentioned earlier, in terms of batteries continuing to improve, we're going to get to a point in the not so distant future where the batteries will outlast the chassis of the vehicles. And in our market, the chassis are required to last for 12 years, and we're already seeing variants of batteries on the market that could handle 12 years plus in a transit application.
Fascinating. You know, sorry, I was going to say, what it really goes to, though, is if you're selling buses to transit agencies, obviously cost, and not just the upfront cost, but life cycle, operations, all of these things. Well, can you talk to that a little? You know, what is the difference from an upfront cost, you know, similar to a personal decision to buy an EV versus a combustion engine? How does that factor in the short term versus over the life cycle of the asset from a cost savings or to the transit agencies?
That's a great question. And we just announced our 100th fleet customer. And so we're starting to get a sample size that's large enough to recognize different patterns within the fleet vehicle market. I would say for everyone involved in this space that's interested in deploying battery electric buses, there is definitely an awareness and a concern around the local environment and the global environment. However, that's not priced into the deal. Mm-hmm. So I think what starts the conversation is a sustainability concern about, or an awareness that a municipal transit agency probably is not going to be able to run diesel in an urban environment in the long term. So they know they have to shift to something different. They do research, and the dominant research at this point would suggest that EV is going to be the long term solution. But in order for someone to actually take the plunge, they have to understand the economic value proposition. And the battery electric bus today is 50% more expensive upfront than the diesel bus. 5 years ago, the battery electric bus was 100% more expensive. Wow. So it is on a rapid cost down curve. That 50% premium has to be paid back via energy savings and spare parts and maintenance.
Because there's less parts, right?
That's right. And the internal combustion engine industry, it's the same issue we're seeing on the EV side with dealers being reluctant to sell electric vehicles.
Yeah.
If you produce an engine or a vehicle, in the past, the most profitable element of that business is selling a continuous stream of spare parts at a high margin. Someone's purchased a $20,000 car, you're probably going to get them to be able to buy a $400 part to keep that thing running. That problem is even is more extreme on the transit bus side. And so we estimate that the savings from reduced spare parts purchases could exceed the savings from energy. And the most specific example of that we have so far is in brake systems. An electric vehicle regenerates energy with the electric motor. It doesn't touch the mechanical brakes unless it absolutely has to. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is the durability of the braking systems in our buses is vastly exceeding internal combustion engine vehicles. And that is a very expensive process to change out discs and pads on an internal combustion engine bus.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I'd like to turn to policy, our favorite topic on the podcast. You recently testified on Capitol Hill about electric buses and the opportunities there. Could you talk a little about that testimony and what recommendations you brought to Congress?
Yeah, I hope I came across as being a pragmatist about how we should approach the challenge of energy diversification. And the main point I was trying to express is that there are many markets that are economically viable today. And if you start with those markets, you can allow industries to scale, mm-hmm. improve their cost structure, and then enter those later markets. And there's a desire to sort of tackle everything at once. And when you try to wrap your head around how big these markets are, the transit bus market is very large. The school bus market is even larger. Delivery trucks, and it just keeps growing by orders of magnitude. Mm-hmm. And I think policy should be about catalyzing profitable industries. Because if you push a technology into a category before it can really get to a place where it can return investor capital, you are going to have to subsidize that industry for a long, long, long time. The fracking industry is a great example of that. That industry just continues to consume capital. Mm-hmm. It might be closing in on $1 trillion of invested capital at this point without free cash flow coming out. The way to avoid that is to start with smaller islands, prove out the technology, and then you've got an economic incentive for businesses to enter into the market and you can start pulling back on subsidies. So I highlighted a number of markets where I thought that there was economic potential right now today. And given that we don't have the capacity to produce an electric vehicle for every vehicle out there on the road today, let's start with the ones that make the most economic sense.
Mm-hmm. And what did you recommend? Was it grant funding, increasing grant funding through the low no emissions program? Was it, what other asks did you have for Congress?
I think we had a couple specific points. One of the points we made is that the Department of Energy ATVM loan mm-hmm. guarantee program, which is still sitting on several billion dollars of appropriated but unallocated funding.
Yeah.
It was designed originally focused on light duty vehicles only. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you wanted a great example of how focused we are on just thinking about cars in America, look at that policy.
Yeah.
I think it was up to a $25 billion program and it was light duty vehicles only.
Yep.
So unless someone builds a really small truck or a really small bus, you can't touch it. And there aren't light-duty EV programs that have been going after that funding or getting approved. So that was one. Say, let's expand our electric vehicle focus to include the commercial vehicle sector. Mm-hmm. Another one is that we suggested that FTA support for transit projects, and the FTA supports about 50% of the capital expenditure in general. We proposed that funding should be calibrated based on the energy efficiency of the technology deployed. Because if you are subsidizing a city or a county, you would naturally want to provide them with technologies and products that are going to have the lowest ongoing operating cost so they don't have to come back for more funding.
It's just a responsible thing to do.
That's right. Mm-hmm. If you're going to subsidize the construction of a house, it's probably a good idea to put in double pane windows and LEDs. You will lower the operating burden for the owner of the home.
Is that a challenge, though? A lot of times there's one pot of money that is to buy buses, and then there's another pot of money that is to maintain and operate buses. If the savings in buying a bus up front from my buy buses pot is more expensive, are not going to be felt, and on that, does that create a perverse disincentive?
What you describe is correct in terms of the different pools of funding, and there are so many different pools of funding, I lose track at the federal and state level. But the main ones are for things like vehicle and facility CapEx. What we find, though, is generally there's a higher level of support for capital investment than there is for ongoing operating expenses.
It's true across the board. If it has a ribbon that you can put on it, then...
That's right. It's also it's easier from an appropriations perspective to fund something that has a one-time upfront cost versus mm-hmm. set up an agency and assume that you will be able to fund their operational expenses for the next 15 years. So I would say in the case of EVs, that plays to the advantage for EVs, because transit agencies in the U.S. are more likely to be able to obtain capital asset funding.
That's true.
Whereas operating expenses are less likely to be subsidized. So it can change the payback to be a very different calculation, because they got more help on the CapEx side and they're more worried about OpEx.
That's actually a great point.
So it's really interesting. And I think, we do a lot of discussions around autonomous vehicles. And I feel like, with the work that we're doing at Stantec, we're looking at a lot of smart mobility plans. And so right now is this great time to be thinking about how to plan for our future of transportation and what are the technologies that are viable today. And just talking with you and the reading I've been doing on electrification, it seems like the electric bus has this opportunity to kind of make the bus attractive again. And I'm curious, do you have any tips for cities or regional transportation planning agencies as they're doing these long-range transportation plans? How can they really look at a bus to help enhance and create a more robust transportation system? And then I'm also curious, when you talk about the potential revenue savings from switching to electrification, I'm also wondering if, we can also talk about the potential for more ridership. So people understanding, okay, if I choose to take the bus, my option is having less of an impact on the environment as well. So how do we make this kind of a more holistic conversation around the value of transportation and the impacts of my transportation choices?
Well, there are so many converging trends in urban mobility right now. I think it is one of the most interesting parts of the economy to look at. And everything is changing. If you look at how micro mobility did not exist at all a couple years ago, and now it's part of the first mile, last mile solution. And that's just one example. I would say our biggest advice to transit agencies when they're thinking about their bus fleets is to remember the inherent flexibility that you get with bus assets versus heavier fixed investments like light and heavy rail.
Streetcars.
Right. What we know is that people tend not to live in a city exactly where we expected them to live.
Yeah.
Sometimes transit-oriented development can be challenging because sometimes you aren't able to predict. But bus routes, you can change them. They're very flexible. And the reality is we don't know when AVs are going to be commercialized in an urban environment. I tend to think that the urban environment is going to be the most complicated environment. I think we'll see it in long-haul trucking way before we see it in the city streets that our buses operate on. Mm-hmm. But we know it's coming in some levels. And the electric bus is going to be a very flexible tool that can react. I would also say I think it's important to recognize that there's not going to be one tool that does everything. And we build 35-foot and 40-foot electric buses, so we'd be biased to say all you need are electric buses and your city's going to work great from a transportation perspective. There are a lot of missions that buses do a phenomenal job at, but there are routes where a full-size heavy-duty electric bus isn't necessarily the right asset. So I think we should be thinking about networks and systems. And if your transit systems, generally, you're going to want to set them up so that they have high frequency of service and that they are relieving congestion on your most valuable routes. And then where the rest of it plays in, if we have autonomous micro taxis, those could be very effective feeders into those systems and into rail as well, and micro mobility.
So maybe, you know, you brought up something that made me think about as we're talking about the future design of a bus or potential applications of the bus. We have the blackouts that are going on in California right now. And we were talking offline about some of the great innovations you've done at your home to allow another use of the batteries is for storage. And so I'm curious, you know, I didn't hear you talk about, you're talking about electric buses. Is there potential for electric buses to also have solar panels and then to be essentially electricity generators as well in the future? And how does that play into the context of what we're seeing going on in California, where some people might be concerned saying, well, if we don't have electric power, then we're not going to be able to power or charge our buses, and then we won't be able to operate that day.
That's right. Well, I think what we're seeing in California, and we are seeing throughout the world, is how vulnerable our conventional energy system is and how climate change is making natural disasters, extreme storms, more frequent, more common. You can look at what's going on in California right now, and the root cause of that is the fact that our wildfire season just keeps getting longer and worse and more intense. But you also have other examples. When Hurricane Harvey came through the Gulf of Mexico, knocked out the oil refineries in Houston, it also cut off barge traffic. And Florida and a lot of the southern states that aren't sitting on a pipeline for refined product are dependent on fuel coming across on a barge. Mm-hmm. So we see in natural disaster after natural disaster, conventional energy, its ability to deliver is exhausted within hours or within days. The future that we need to be moving towards is one where an event that occurs 500, 1,000 miles away doesn't bring down an entire city or an entire region. There was a pipeline rupture, I think, a year or two ago, and it was the first time that Americans realized that there's one pipeline that delivers refined fuel for a significant portion of the East Coast. The future, in my view, is that critical infrastructure, including fleets, airports, they're going to have their own ability to generate that will probably be solar. They will be on the grid because there are network effects to being on the grid. And they will have stationary storage. And that stationary storage will probably include the electric vehicles themselves that they operate. And so I envision a transit yard where you have covered parking, which is typical for transit yards. That covered parking is completely covered with solar. And you have several containers of what are probably going to be used bus batteries that are providing backup. You might also have a genset, especially if you're on a gas pipeline. But the transit systems in the long term should be energy islands, and they should be capable of self-generation. School bus, I think, is another great example. And if we were in a world today where school buses were electrified and we had vehicle-to-grid capability, and both of those technologies exist, they just haven't been deployed, you could immediately after a hurricane sweeps through or a wildfire goes through, you could drive, and each one is about a quarter megawatt hour, you could drive energy storage on wheels in the form of those school buses to a neighbor that needs help and plug in and get hospitals back up online. So where we are today, we have a very fragile system. We're seeing it does not take much to bring down the fossil fuel system or to cause oil prices to jump $20 a barrel. And I think the solution for that is we ought not to replicate that centralized system. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, we need a national grid. The grid is extremely important. We need to modernize it. But the more we have distributed energy and solar, the less we have binary outcomes when natural disasters occur.
Absolutely.
And then from a policy perspective, are you engaging with the utility companies on this discussion as well? Because I think a lot of cities, a lot of counties, a lot of states are moving towards electrification. And I think sometimes they forget to include the electricity provider.
That's right. This morning I was at Exelon's innovation event, and we make it a point to engage with utilities, with groups like EPRI, EEI, with the Department of Energy, because this is a convergence. The transportation energy sector and the electricity sector are coming together, and we encourage our transit customers, as soon as they start considering electric buses, to engage with their local utility. What we found, which is really exciting in this era, is for the most part, the utilities get it. It's a different world than it was 5 years ago, and they especially get the potential for fleet electrification. There's a lot more value that fleet electrification creates for a utility than an electric car here and there. So we found, I can't think of an example where a utility has been difficult to work with. And in many cases, they've really leaned into this and helped the transit agency understand where to do the charging, how to do a transformer upgrade, and in many cases, funded much of the infrastructure.
Wow. Well, Ryan, thank you. We're running out of time, but we really appreciate you joining us. So let's say that folks on the West or East Coast want to ride in a Proterra bus. Where could they go?
We have a great map on our website that shows you where all our deployments are. I think that even if you're in Alaska or Hawaii, you're not too far away from a Proterra electric bus at this point. Mm-hmm. I think we have customers now in over 40 states and two Canadian provinces.
Wow.
So I hesitate to recommend a specific fleet because...
so just pick your favorite.
Right. Yeah. you know, one of the neat things is that we're to the point now where electric buses are deployed in all of our home-based markets.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, ride an electric bus in Greenville, South Carolina. That's the Greenlink system. Ride an electric bus with San Jose, which is VTA, or SamTrans, San Mateo County. If you fly into San Jose Airport, mm-hmm. There are 10 battery electric buses that are providing passenger service there.
Excellent.
And then in LA County, where our West Coast factory is located, we have buses deployed with Foothill Transit, which was the very first Proterra customer. So everyone should be able to get to an electric bus experience without traveling too far.
Great. It just sounds like we need an electric bus road trip and do some podcasting.
Yeah, it does. Maybe we'll record inside of one.
We just dropped off some in Breckenridge. So, I mean, if you have to go to Breckenridge,
there are worse places to end up right now. I mean, that sounds pretty nice.
And let us go.
We'll work on that. It'll be the next episode.
Yeah.
They're in Park City as well. So, you know, you could do a winter mountain town tour.
I like
that. Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Missoula, Montana.
Are skis transportation? Anyways, so Ryan, if folks want to learn more about Proterra, where can they go? Also, is there a Twitter account they could follow or a website?
Yeah, absolutely. Find us on Twitter. Our website also has a lot of good information on it, and you can sign up to be part of our distribution. We're constantly publishing news and updates on the overall industry.
Great. And Greg Rodriguez, where can we find you?
At Smarter Transpo.
And this is Pete. I'm at Shared Mobility S.
And this is Greg Rogers from SAFE, at AV Greg R. Follow the Mobility Podcast at Mobility Podcast. Check out our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Ryan, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.